Beyond is sponsored by the Malone Society, whose works help keep alive the plays we work on. The Malone Society regularly publishes volumes of early plays which otherwise might not be available. To join the Society or find out more about their publications, go to malonesociety.com for more information. Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast. And today we are joined with someone who is here to talk about the practicality of performing an early modern text in an early modern way. I say early modern. We can go back to the medieval with this as well, in the sense that for straightforward practical reasons, paper's expensive. And so rather than print out an entire script, because they can't really do that, especially not in the medieval period, people will be presented with a cue script, and someone who has been doing practical work on how cue scripts might have functioned is with me today. So my wonderful guest, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
Oh my golly, well, I am Lizzie Conrad Hughes. I am artistic director for... I've got permission to say the name of my company?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm artistic director for Shake Scene Shakespeare. And you all heard that I had dispensation to say that. And yeah, that is what I do. Shake Scene is the currently the longest established theatre company dedicated to performing from cued parts. Following a pattern established... Well... Shall I just get into the story of modern cue-based?
Shall we start?
Yeah.
What is a cue script? Let's start. First principles.
Bottom line, what is a cue script? Well, a cue script or a cued part, depending which term you want to use, basically it means, say you and I, Rob, are members of an early modern acting company, and we have just been told our casting for an upcoming play. We would not receive the entire script because the company only has one, possibly two, which is in manuscript form, probably collated in different handwritings by the different writers who've written their different bits, and the play has been shuffled together into one volume. So there might be two copies. There's probably only one. The company are not letting that go. They have got somebody, possibly a professional scribe, possibly their bookholder, somebody has copied out all the parts. So each character in the play has their own part, which would be simply the ... cue to enter. And this could be an audible cue, it could be a visual cue, depending on the part and the playhouse that potentially it was going to be performed in. You would then enter and you would either speak immediately if you saw your lines were there, or you would be looking for another ... And then there would be another cue of, it never shorter than one syllable for obvious reasons, professional parts somewhere between one and four syllables on average is the length of your cue. So you might get, yes, my lord, or you might just get, my lord. And that's what you're listening to. Right. And that is when you speak. And you keep, every time you hear your cue, you know that you are cued to speak. You will similarly see ... cue to exit, which you would do. You are in the parts. There is no scene number. There is no act number. You might have a note of telling you to enter in disguise or with a particular prop. You would be told there are one or two lovely directions like he fights him and he wins. It's like, okay, so that's going to be interesting to work out. And that's basically all the information you would get in just your part. So what we work from at Shake Scene is a slightly modernized, adapted version of that, because I started doing this work before I did my PhD research. So I've just finished 7 years of that. And so I know a lot more about the history of it than I did when I started out. But we have a modern format of parts, which is slightly more informative. When I was working, doing the research workshops for my doctorate, then we were working from parts which were more pared down. We were following the outline of the one surviving professional part that we have from this early modern era.
Mm, yes, because I was going to ask, you know, how many we have one.
It's insane. Well, it's absolutely insane. I don't know where they are, but at some point there are going to be a load more. Because I've forgotten what the number was, but I worked out if you have, say you've got six professional companies, you know, on any one day in London, and you've got 30 members of that company. And each member of that company knows 30 to 40 parts, which is what they reckon they knew. That was, I mean, that's hundreds of thousands of parts. Just physical pieces of parchment must have existed at some point. I mean, what you there is one professional. I keep saying professional because there are more amateur ones.
Yes, I was going to say I was going to throw in going. Yeah. I've done others.
Yes. But when I did my doctorate, I was advised to be extremely precise and stick to the London playhouses and to stick to professional, because amateur theatre is and university theatre are based different sort of preparational rules and rehearsal expectations than the professional playhouses with their daily turnover.
Yeah, because in occasional performance, the circumstances are very different.
The intention of the exercise is different.
It is very different. The people producing it are quite different. Often there's a teacher-student element to it, where there's almost more direction potentially involved. And in fact, the scripts are often more complicated because it's like, no, I know what this scene is about. I know what this play is about because I wrote it. You got to do it right. So it's full of lots of really short, pithy, comically timed bits of dialogue, which professional playing companies do, but not necessarily to the same degree that, say, a play like Res Publica, which is unbelievably complicated to do, the central comic vice figures. And then also, if you go back to the medieval with mystery drama, where, again, we know people had parts. We have surviving Shrewsbury.
We do.
We have one person's part there. But they're probably doing the same play every year.
Yes.
And this is going to... I'm going to circle back to this point about returning to FX, but I'll come back to it later. Anyway, so that's the context. So whereas the difference for professional playhouse company or professional touring company or both is that they are constantly turning over new shows every few weeks. There's a new show to learn and retain.
There are always potboilers. There are. I did a study of like Lord Strange's Men, 1 4-month residency they did at the Rose. It's from Henslowe's day book, so of course you have to be a little bit careful about how literally you take Henslowe. But I mean, it's there, it's in front of you, let's use it. It might as well be true. And it was interesting to me to kind of know, okay, there are definite favourites that are coming up, you know, every week or every other week. Jew of Malta turned up a lot, Spanish Tragedy turned up a lot. So that's kind of fun, because once you've got that one going in that space, then clearly it doesn't need attention. In the same way as, like, you know, okay, we've done 10 plays since the last time we did it, but we've done this play 20 times in the last year. So it's not going to be the same kind of weight or problem of you know, getting it back up and running.
Yeah, and the nature of memory and how that works. I mean, I know from my own practice that you can basically, if you decide not to forget the play you've done, if you know you're going to do it again, retention is remarkable.
Yeah.
Remarkable. As a storyteller, I would, you know, put a story aside for years and then come back and it would take a day and I could do a reasonably good version of it. And so that's where the utility of cue scripts, and again, this is something we might circle back to later, of how useful they are once the play is on. But let's go back to first principles.
Yes.
So people have known about the practice of cue scripts for a long time.
Yes.
Cue scripts were still being used into the 20th century.
Yes, they were, absolutely.
Because
slightly
everyone...
differently, one has to say.
Absolutely.
Because you're dealing with... Because it's weekly, fortnightly rep, and they're copying out their part because they're trying to sort of reduce the number of copies of the play. So you're dealing with parts which are copied from plays, but the plays themselves are not necessarily written with the same awareness of this is how they are going to be. I mean, there's a very reasonable and enjoyable argument on my part for saying a parts basis is really the only justifiable way of studying any play from the early modern, because that was the way they were written to be studied. You know, the playwrights knew that this is what was going to happen, that they would be cut down into parts. This is the kind of information that, that the actors would get and the kind of process they'd go through to get them on. So that's just a fun argument to have with people sometimes.
Yeah. However, it has been studied in our modern times as to how perhaps to work with Q scripts. So what's been the practice before your practice, as it were?
Okay. So we go back to the 1980s and the committees that were meeting on, if we're talking specifically about the clients of modern practitioners experimenting with what they believed cue-based practice to be in the early modern. So according to my research, it goes back to the meetings that were being had about the Sam Wanamaker globe rebuild project. Well, rebuild.
Big air quotes happened.
Big
there,
air quotes
people.
Happened then. Big, yes, that was
we are a podcast. Air quotes occurred just there.
So there was a lot of talk about authenticity and original. Well, original practices was their word. Sam Wanamaker was very keen on as much original, you know, being as close to doing it how they did. So there were all these conversations about original music and movement and clothes and fabrics and instruments and all this stuff. And I don't know who, but the story is, as told by the man himself, is that somebody said, what about original rehearsal techniques? Shouldn't we use those? And apparently everybody looked at everybody else and realised that nobody knew what they were because nobody had ever researched them. So there was a theatre and TV director in the room, Patrick Tucker, and he kind of went, okay, then I'm doing that. And he went to the Dulwich archive. He had a look at the one surviving part, which is Orlando from Orlando Furioso by Robert Greene. So I'm allowed to mention him.
Mention Robert Greene as much as you like. We love a bit of Green. limb bashing.
Yes, limb carrying.
Yeah.
So he looked at that part and he looked at the kind of information, the amount of information that was in there. And he looked at Henslowe's diary and saw the daily turnover. And he drew the not unreasonable conclusion that therefore that he saw no time for a director-led immersive rehearsal process, such as post-Stanislavski actors, modern actors would deem absolutely essential. There's no other way to do it. You've got to be in a room for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 3 months or however much budget you've got. And you're there and you're all doing the read and discuss and peel the onion kind of psychology, and that everybody's got to understand everything. And then you rehearse the whole play. So he saw that there was no time for that, which there isn't. Not according to our lights, anyway. Not to our period. And so he came to the conclusion that therefore there was no rehearsal. And he knew about parts, because we have little evidences from, well, meta-theatrical references in plays of the time about actors receiving their part, working from their part, being out of their part. There is a fashion at one point for play prologues where actors are arriving and kind of going, oh, hi, who are you playing today? Oh, gee, is that the play we're doing? So there was all this evidence for no rehearsal, just knowing your part, not knowing what else was going on. And he started experimenting with, you know, actually holding workshops with actors that he knew, and it all seemed to go very well, that people would just have their part. They'd have a few simple basic directions. They'd maybe have a one-to-one with him on the text. Nobody read the play. Nobody was given the play. You were discouraged from reading the play. And basically, yeah, he off the back of that, created a company, the Original Shakespeare Company, and they did 28 productions of various plays, mostly by the guy we don't name. In fact, entirely by the guy we don't name. That included, they did two productions using their technique at the Globe in its opening years. Then that kind of folded. And there are various stories about why that didn't go any further. And that
they're
company,
the kind of stories we discuss off mic, but we're positive. Yes, we're a positive group.
We are indeed. And plus, they're in all sorts of books, so you can read them.
You can find the gossip elsewhere.
I'm not going to give away anything new if I told it, but it's that. So that didn't. But So, there was a very strong enthusiasm for this work in the actors who were doing it, and in Patrick Tucker and his partner Christine Ozanne, and so they really believed in it, and they kept it going for quite some time, and then gradually, as things life progresses, there is an interesting little hookup in the worlds of practice and theory-based academia. I'm never quite sure how to say it, but because Patrick Tucker's niece is Professor Tiffany Stern of the Shakespeare Institute, who is an amazing, amazing person. She did her PhD on rehearsal from to Sheridan. Basically, she wanted to research her Uncle Patrick's theories and sort of look into the history behind them. Didn't come to a particularly strong conclusion about whether or not, but she had a general feeling that there was more rehearsal than possibly Patrick Tucker had at first imagined. But she, being more of a sort of historical, a document-based researcher, that's kind of her side. So the technique continued in the Drama Studio London, used it for many years as their introduction to for their students, being taught by former members of Patrick's company. But it didn't really catch on over here. It caught on in America in a slightly different way. Basically, what happened was, you know, so that kind of went a bit fallow. And then in about 2010, 2011, I picked up Patrick Tucker's book. He wrote a book, The Secrets of Acting Shakespeare. And I was at that time researching. I'd been persuaded to start teaching, and I thought, I'd better read that. And it was all about cue-based acting. And I had one of those moments where I mean, I know it's metaphorical, but I almost literally felt my brain explode. Just, this is what I've been looking for. This is the excitement, the spontaneity, the commitment, the passion. This is what I've been looking for. And I was like, I want to do this. I desperately have to do this. And because all my friends are actors, if you say to a bunch of actors, hey, do you fancy doing a workshop on something really crazy? A bunch of people said yes. So we started workshopping. And at first it was a disaster, so we went back to the drawing board and we started again and we built. And every time, you know, I read everything I could get my hands on, which is not much. There's very little written about this. I can itemize the books for you if you really want to know, but because they're all in my doctorate. After about a couple of years, I kind of went, no, this is it. This is me. I love this now. And I took my metaphorical flag and I went, right, this is me. I'm committing to this technique now. And that became Shakescene, and Shakescene's been going for 9 years now. Well, coming into our ninth year. So, yeah, that's where it began. This is how it got to me. Where's it going next? Working on that one.
Yeah, because I think one of the big connected things that previously hasn't necessarily been properly explored for very good practical reasons, which is living with these texts.
Yes.
Living with this practice. Because, of course, the problem with recreating an early modern rehearsal process is unless you have a permanent company that is doing this.
Of men and boys who do nothing else.
Who do nothing else. Because the question is, you know, basically, what is everyone doing all day? because an early modern actor, again, one of the problems of recreating this is they probably worked considerably longer hours than our union will allow. Because what do? They start at daylight and they stop. They probably stop after the show in the afternoons because they're performing in the afternoons, you know, going on till five, tidy up, six. They probably go to the pub and maybe do some work on text. But they've got since dawn to do something. And my experience, as we were just saying, of, you know, if you've already performed the text before, and most of the time they're performing a text that they've already performed. It might be the one they performed a couple of weeks ago or the few...
It needs a little spit and polish.
It needs a spit and polish. But so what are they doing all day? And are they going to spend all their time rehearsing the show that they've already rehearsed or are they and already performed? Because once you've performed something before an audience, you tend to not...
It might need a few workings depending on the technical challenges.
Fight
but
calls or whatever. Anything that's technically complicated. So the idea that, you know, that... There must be something going on, and some people will have slightly different jobs to be doing during the day, or they might be doing some publicity, or they might be doing, you know, going out and sorting something that's gone horribly, horribly wrong. But the idea that you're sort of pushing against of, mm-hmm. you know, that there is no rehearsal. Mm-hmm. There isn't a modern rehearsal concept, perhaps. But they've got to be doing something.
Well, I mean,
because how do you arrange your day? What are you doing all day?
One, define rehearsal.
Mm.
Because spending time studying your part, learning your part, possibly talking to the writer, or if you're an apprentice, your master player, all of that is rehearsal of a kind.
Mm.
So it's not... In the States, it's referred to as unrehearsed. And I'm like, no, it isn't. I'm just... If you want to annoy me, just say that. Because that is a form of rehearsal. Actually, one of the things I did look at during my doctorate was, what was the idea of a working day? What were the number of hours were you expected to do? And in winter, it's something like, it's not even daybreak. It's 6 until about 8 in winter. And in summer, it's more like 5 until 9. So even in winter, when you would be getting up and it would still be dark, you are expected to be at work in some form from 6 o'clock. You get, I think it's like, you get a breakfast break after a couple of hours. You get a lunch break. You get an afternoon break. And then you're done once you're released. So actually, there is oodles of time in the day. And if you allow, there is one of the things I also looked at in my research, there is a massive assumption that nobody ever spent money on candles. Because and I find it really annoying, because almost everything I read was candles cost money, so actors never spent money on candles, so they could not be learning their part unless it was daytime. And I'm like, that is just so not true. That is like somebody, like in a 500 years time, looking at our era, seeing that gas and electricity cost money and saying, well, therefore nobody ever used them, which is, of course, nonsense. I mean, we all know. What do? We moderate as much as we can. You know, we try and stay within a budget, and we use what we can afford.
We only light that candle when we damn well need it.
Yeah, but I mean, but if you're living, you know, if you're in your lodgings, you know, say it's eight o'clock at night, and you're back in your lodgings, and you've got a part to learn, you've got a candle lit, because otherwise you can't walk around your room because you've got to carry your light with you. So there is light there, and it was possible to light public spaces. They had torches, they had cressets, you know. So it's like, you could light an inn courtyard, you can light a playhouse stage yard. So it's like, why? Yes, it would have been moderated and stayed within a budget, but there's no reason to just go, nobody ever did that. And I'm looking at that going, that's not reasonable. So you've got plenty of time. And say you wake up and, you know, it's 5:45, you said your prayers, you've got your hose on, whatever, and you've start 6 o'clock, maybe you start doing an hour's line learning or an hour and a half's line learning. You're at work then. You could be required to be at the playhouse for 6 o'clock, in which case you've got to get your bum out of bed earlier, and you've got to take time to travel, and you would probably be carrying a lantern. So here is your light. It's come with you. So, yeah, there's actually a chunk more time available than has been assumed. It would not have been rehearsal in the way that we understand it. I mean, there is no evidence for, like, a director. Someone who was only that external eye. Yes, it's arguable. And one thing I want, okay, you should just see his face right now. There is absolutely, there is no way to say this never happened or this always happened. I am never going to try and persuade you that there was not one company where one person fancied themselves as kind of a director, and that's what they did.
I think there's several elements to this in the face that I just pulled.
Yeah.
So one of which is thinking of this in a musical sense of conductor is a relatively modern thing, but that doesn't mean to say that you don't have first violin who is leading.
Yeah, the leader of the orchestra.
And the companies are very hierarchical, so there's some sort of organizational basis going on there. I mean, there are sort of evidences, but they are slightly different companies. So it's like Boys Company. you know, we've got reasonable suggestion that maybe the author is pushing things. So Ben Johnson, you know, I mean, there is a real sense with Ben Johnson that he is directing from the rear,
absolutely,
all the way. But you're right, and so the idea of an auteur director laying down the line is not there. But that again is not quite what we're talking about here, in the sense that, you know, they are preparing. Different companies are doing different things.
Always,
and
they're facing the same. They're facing the same needs.
Yeah,
the same challenges, but they are. They will inevitably have different ways of getting around them. In the exact same way that back in 2020, when we all went online for lockdown performances, there was us. There were yourselves at Beyond. There were the other companies that were doing, you know, online performances. We were all facing the same needs and decisions and challenges.
Mm.
And, you know, Shake Scene made one bunch of decisions. Mm. Show Must Go Online made another bunch of decisions. You made your own. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
We all made our own decisions. So we were all. So, and you cannot tell me that wouldn't have happened then.
Well,
because it was exactly the same sort of feeling.
Well, it's also, you know, there are different scale of companies.
Yes.
You know, we've effectively got number one houses and then touring companies who are primarily on tour, and also we've got a massive date range here.
Mm-hmm.
Is that I can actually quite believe that it's all a bit punk and ad hoc in the 1570s. I kind of, once you get into the early 17th century, that the bigger companies are not actually really quite organized in how they function. And that there are things in place, and I think Tiffany Stern has written about using analogues from later playhouses in the Restoration and projecting back about actually how the behind the scenes infrastructure about outsourcing of memory and to other people who are off stage, you know, the bookkeeper, but also potential other people who know when you need to be on stage, get in this costume, shoving you on, and that you don't necessarily need to know those bits of information. But again, that depends on the scale of the company and also the turnover of plays, because the turnover of plays is a problem because we are working off one source as to what the turnover of plays is from a very specific time and quite a specific company
and one specific playhouse.
Exactly,
because only one set of conditions applies within the rows.
Well,
I know there are two
minor iterations,
but basically you're looking at one particular kind of playhouse.
Yeah, so the question of how often you're turning, and the thing is, they have actually quite a good lead time between new productions as well. You know, it's a better part of a month a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
It does vary. Obviously, sometimes things go wrong. They desperately need a new play quick because all the old plays aren't selling as well as they thought they would.
Because that's life, and life is unpredictable, people.
But also, you know, in a well-organized playhouse, you've got plays potentially well in advance, so that people have time to learn them in a more holistic fashion rather than we've got to get this up next week.
Yeah.
And this idea of turnover pressure is, it's not even just about rehearsal, it's about learning your lines. And
but there's time in the day for that.
There is time.
As well as time to rehearse whatever you might be going to do next and thing. I go into a lot of detail in this in my doctorate. I'm not going to say anything more. Actually, I just realised I'm giving away my gold because
you can ask for cuts later. but also just on that thing about Q scripts, because Q scripts initially are really quite annoying.
I love them, but yes, they are. They're wicked.
No,
their
utility comes when you come back to your part.
Okay.
This is the thing. When I've done plays, or I've returned to plays, or I know there's going to be a break between plays, I will, if you know, in a modern context, you have the script.
Yes.
And then, well, I'm coming back to this in a couple of months' time, so I then create a 3-page Q script iteration. Because then it's really useful, because I already know the rest of the stuff.
Yeah, you just want to remember what you're doing.
And that's what's so useful about a Q script when you have a repertoire. Is that you can just pick up your bit of paper and remember what you've got to do. And you don't need all the rest of the information because it's irrelevant. And that's where they become really useful, as opposed to if you initially present someone with a cue script, mm-hmm. it's annoying mm-hmm. because it's like, yes, okay, maybe I don't need the rest of the information.
I'd like it, though.
But I'd like it. But also, I mean, going back to the early modern period, that if they're working on site, where are the books kept? Mm-hmm. Where is the book kept? Mm-hmm. It's on site. I don't believe that they refuse to let you have access to the play that you're rehearsing on some level.
Yeah.
Not detailed take home study, the idea that you don't have an idea of the schema of the play is...
If you think about the process by which plays were created, right? So first out, you're a playwright or a team of playwrights pitch an idea, say, to Henslow. Mm. And Henslow goes, right, I will buy that. Here's your money. I want it in 3 weeks. Mm. So then off you go, your Beaumont, your Fletcher, you kind of go, right, I'll write this bit. We need someone else. Right, go and get Rowley or Decker or Ford to write that bit. Mm. And so you all get together and you agree who's writing which bit, and you agree by when, and then here comes the play. The play becomes a thing. Partway through that process, it is extremely possible that you, the playwright, had an evening session with at least the sharers of the intended company so that they could hear the scenes we've got so far, because they'd be going, my part is, who am I? Okay, I'm here. So you've got your sharers. They want to hear their part. They want to hear that their part is good enough. If they've got an apprentice, they want to know what their apprentice is in for. Mm-hmm. And if that's going to be suitable for that, it's like, no, he needs to be more challenged than that because this is his graduation part or something.
Or he's not doing very well, fewer words.
Yeah,
please.
Could you? Or actually, it's only his second go. Could he have 3 scenes rather than 5? Mm. So there is already, before the play is barely even created, there is already a knowledge of who, for some people in the company, who's going to be playing what and therefore what kind of experience they're in for. Mm. When the play, it would be read, and the playwrights would go away with feedback and kind of going, oh yes, and so he's either correcting or he's continuing or whatever. The play, when it is finished, comes back to, there will be some kind of back and forth. I can't tell you that it was typical, but it is completely possible that the company, in inverted commas, because there's no evidence to say exactly how many members would have turned up for the company, a company reading of the play. But Tiffany Stern lists accounts for beer and wine consumed at readings of X play by Y playwright, you know. So we know that they happened. And if you think about who's in the cut, so the sharers and the apprentices and probably the fellows, or the sort of in-between level, they are committed to the company. Mm. So it's their job to turn up when required. Mm. So if there's a reading of a play, they're going to be, you know, it's their job to be there. They don't need to be paid because it's part of their job. The hired men, yes, you probably would need to pay them to come along. But even that's, and so that's a bit more money, but it's not a lot of money.
But also the hired men, you know, they're depending, not necessarily the having a very large role. So do you need to?
Well,
do
then
you
again,
need to
but then it would
them?
Depend. It's sort of like, well, we can do without Roger and Timothy, but I think we should have Tom because he's got quite a big role. Blah, 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 blah. So they would have heard it through at least once before they got there, you know, and that almost certainly would have been read from parts because you've got one copy of the script. Mm. You can't have 20 or 30 people all trying to read from one book because that way madness lies.
We're going to the weird later convention of one, the author reads the script to the company, which would be...
There were times when the author, I mean, that was something that happened. Mm. But, you know, at the same time, if the whole company is reading the script, then they cannot read from one book. Therefore, as far as I'm concerned, they must have read from their parts, which is also a jolly useful thing to do. Speaking as someone who makes actors do this, if you have a dummy run through of a play that you've just cut into parts, it's really useful to find out where you've
cocked up.
Yeah, where you've missed a bit, where a bit is repeated, or, you know, that's just handy so that you before everything goes seriously into production, you've covered yourself.
And so much of this is based on, again, it's institutional knowledge.
Yes.
Which is the really hard thing to recreate.
Yes.
Is, you know, the things we can do today are often much more peripatetic. Mm-hmm. There's always going to be someone who doesn't really know what's going on in the room, and you haven't necessarily done it as often as you would like.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, in the early modern period, not only do they have that that knowledge base, institutional knowledge base, but everybody knows each other.
Yes. They're very, very well.
Very well. So it's like the writers are writing to actor.
Yep.
They are writing, you know, so they're getting immediate feedback from those actors, mm-hmm. especially if they're sharers, mm-hmm. because, you know, they're the ones you have to please.
Mm-hmm.
But all of those various stakeholders that are in place, mm-hmm. and that's a dynamic relationship that it's quite hard to recreate mm-hmm. with this distance, because...
It's not hard, it's impossible.
Yeah.
So you don't even try.
I mean,
this is the thing. But I maintain that because you can't replicate that, it doesn't mean that everything you do is without value.
No. Which is
where I've been fighting back against, you know, the general sort of tide of attitude that there is to original practices-based work and or research.
Mm.
Because it's like, no, I disagree. I have experienced humans who are professional actors who've been doing cue-based performance. I mean, some of my actors have been with me since the beginning.
Mm.
You know, they got the better part of 10 years of doing this under their belts.
Mm.
And thanks to lockdown, we have a rolling program of performing. Every 4 weeks, we do a play either by, you know, by somebody of the era, because we finished him in 2022, but we didn't want to stop. And now we're having enormous fun sort of linking and going into sort of, you know, there's a lot of other playwrights. Wow, this is fun.
Mm.
But yeah, so if you have people who know what they're doing and who understand the rules of the game, like this is how I set up my research workshops. I only used actors that I'd worked with before, who I trusted their skills. And I designated some of them sharers, some of them apprentices, some of them hired men.
Mm.
At first, just out of sheer evil curiosity on my part, if I do this to them, what does it do? Does it make a difference? Oh, yes, it does. Oh, this is quite fun. And then ultimately, by the end of my sort of... Because I was going to do 4 workshops, I ended up doing 7. And it got much, much bigger and was a lot of fun towards the end. But then we really needed that structure. And it was really... I know this isn't really a word, but it was really pointful. And which was... I was kind of like, oh, good. I'm glad I did that.
Yes, and you know, that these hierarchies are not unimportant to the structure of how everything functions.
Absolutely.
And actually, you know, a modern group will balk against, you know, this is a hierarchy we do not necessarily trust, but it is sort of necessary to get things done, especially as you need to be relatively efficient.
Yes, you do.
It
was quite challenging. I mean, I experimentally, because I take the role of bookholder slash prompter slash whichever term you like.
Yeah. And there are all sorts of questions
really
and evidences about how prompting functions. But anyway, that's an entirely different conversation.
I was taking the sort of role of, because my research was looking at, if you've got these kind of documents, so I'm working with scripts, you know, full scripts, the information you get in parts, and working with plots or replica plot documents. If you've got this amount of information, you've got this amount of time, you've got to get this script, you've got to get this amount of text into performance, go. And I took me right out of the... I decided for the purposes of research, what if the bookholder is not the actively stage managing director? What if that is not there? Does it still work? And the answer is yes, of course it does, in spades.
Yeah.
Because actors have a healthy sense of self-preservation, if nothing else.
Yes.
And they want to do a good job. They want to work together. They're enjoying themselves. And it was interesting because the sharers did tend to stand forward and be more like, right, we've got to move on and it's cold in here. Can someone turn the heater up? And you'd find the apprentices giggling in a corner, which was... everybody was working, but it was just interesting to kind of go, all right, so this is not my job. I leave that to them because they're higher status. And the actors, they found their own way. And if somebody was not in a scene and they were sitting and watching, then they would give as it were, directorial input. And if you had someone who was a specialist, a fight specialist or a comedy specialist, then they would be putting more into a sequence if, as and when appropriate.
Mm.
And I didn't, you know, that was not a pre-requirement. That happened quite naturally.
Mm.
So I'm going, well, yeah, this works.
Mm. I mean, one of the sort of on future things that I want to be doing with what we're doing, which is where we sort of eventually might collide in a productive way, not in a
Titanic way.
Not in a Titanic way. is that sort of my focus at the moment, especially because just logistics and money, is looking at the earlier repertoire.
Yes.
With smaller companies who may be more doing occasional drama, but the, you know, there are plenty of touring interluders that are out there. And the way that professional drama in the Elizabethan comes together is actually about the merging of companies. That no, there is no genesis for a theatre company, really, prior to maybe the King's Men in 1490 or whatever year it is, the original King's Men. Because every theatre company that comes up into existence afterwards is made of a previous theatre company.
Yes.
And what happens is, as theatre companies get bigger, it's actually sort of a collision of different, and they're bringing their script and their knowledge, and how do they then come together? And going from not a vast number of plays that you're turning over, probably because you're touring and you don't need as many, to we're now in a playhouse and we need to turn over because the audiences aren't going to keep coming back, of actually establishing a repertoire with a relatively small number of people, and then building from that the practice, and building, hopefully, you know, by that point, we'll have more money, therefore we can hire more people, and we can do a much more practical question of, okay, we know these plays, and now we have to learn a new play every week. And suddenly six other people from a totally different company have turned up and they're now part of us. How does that work? And trying to emulate the process that gets us to the Elizabethan Playhouse.
Yeah.
And that's sort of my gambit. Because, I, in the best will in the world, I don't think I can hire more than four or five people for any length of time.
Nope.
In this economy.
Yeah.
But if we can build that repertoire, and then it'd be really interesting to, I mean, I for the listeners' benefit, there should also be acknowledged that there is quite a crossover of personnel between
our groups already,
in a sense we're sort of already doing it in a weird way.
I was going to say, well, between Shakespeare and beyond, we share Shakespeare and beyond, we share a lot of people one way or another, and you know, my guys end up with you, and then we pick up people from, and it's terrific. It's perfectly natural. It's like people who are interested in doing the sort of stuff that we do, obviously, are also interested in what the others, you know, what the other group does. But yeah, I mean, so that, and again, that is an absolute modern parallel with what definitely happened, you know, in the day. Because I mean, if you're an apprentice and you've done your 7 years with Strangest Men or something, you graduate, you know, with your role that is, you know, your high level role, and you get congratulations, well done. Sorry, lad, we don't have a sharer's opening for you at the moment, so good luck. And then you basically become you either just become a sort of floating hired man, or you go to one of the other companies and go, hey, just graduated from Strangers. I heard you might have an opening. And so there is already sort of cross-pollination going on there, because, like I said, you know, you can only have so many sharers in any one company.
Yeah.
And obviously that's presumably where a lot of people wanted to get to. But as with the acting profession today, you know, there's a lot more people who want jobs than
are available.
Than the jobs are necessarily available.
Especially in this economy. As we... It's a cold, bleak world out there, people.
Yes, but we create so much warmth and joy, and all patrons and Patreons are warmly welcome.
Yes, I think we have not covered everything, but we also have probably run out broadly of time. And yes, mentioning patronage and interest, where can the universe find you?
Where can you find us? We have a Patreon, Shakespeare, and there are levels of Patreon from £5 a month to 60, I think, and it gets you different kinds of access to our in-person shows. We also have our rolling program of online plays. So every 4 weeks, we do a play live on Zoom, well, on YouTube, we're working on Zoom, which is a continuation from lockdown. I have accidentally developed a global company of actors and audience who do not want to stop working together. I don't want to stop working with them. We have too much fun. And I know that by the time this goes out, this is going to be history. But January's play is Galatea by John Lilly. We're then going to do a quick visit into one of the ones that I can't name, by that guy. But in March and April, we're doing The Two Robin Hoods by Anthony Munday. And then that's going to roll on to another one. So we're doing a sort of theme of pastoral and things at the moment. And
the Anthony Munday Robin Hood plays that start so well and then turn into something very different.
We did part one a couple of years ago, and I promised the company we'd do part two. Yeah, I know. It's been fun. I'm really lucky, actually.
No spoilers. You know, we won't tell you what happens. It doesn't end well.
It's in the title. But anyway. So every 4 weeks we do a play live online. If you do social media, you can find us on Facebook, on TikTok, on Instagram, on Blue Sky, and on X, which I still want to call Twitter. And so Shake Scene, Shake Scenery, something. We're on all of those. Tickets are live on Eventbrite. We also have a website, and everything is posted up on there. So basically, if you Google Shake-Scene Shakespeare, you will find us popping up all over the place.
Links will be available in the show description.
Thank you very much. In March this year, so March the 8th and the 15th, we're doing a double bill of two plays that we performed last year at Prescott. But we're bringing them back to... Basically, this is our return to London, our first return to London since lockdown, believe it or not. So that is happening. And then in August, if you happen to be anywhere near Prescott, just outside Liverpool, we will be performing two plays there. I'm probably going to get this wrong, but I think it's something like the 5th, 6th, 7th of August. We will be in their outdoor venue again. But this is the third year running we will have been there. And yeah, so we are around. We are constantly, every month we're live on the internet, and increasingly we are live in person. So as with so many other companies, we're just fighting our way back now after the great joy that was what happened in 2020. So
Yes, well, again, another intersection with the early modern, dealing with plague. And on that cheerful note, all that remains to thank my wonderful guests for being wonderful. Thank you very much, and goodbye.
Thank you, bye-bye.